Welcome to Symptomatic Redness, a podcast for those who are pathologically interested in history, critical theory, philosophy, aesthetics, or anything that may inform the modern world.
Today we're talking with Donald Parkinson of Cosmonaut Magazine on democratic norms and communist republicanism. This is part one of a two-part conversation.
Welcome to Symptomatic Redness. Today we're talking to Donald Parkinson of Cosmonaut and of Swanside Chats. And we're going to be talking about a specific article in the history around that article. And also probably we'll start off a bit talking about the Cosmonaut Project and your historical studies and studies of interest. So just a little background about you and I. We go back. Yeah, we go back. You came into my orbit when I was, I think I was still in Platypus.
I think it was around the time that Platypus kind of had that implosion. It didn't implode, but it had like a mini implosion.
Right.
And yeah, yeah,
we started the ETI and we both thought we were lefcons for a hot minute and then realized that we weren't.
I think it's funny because we both, you know, we have a past as lefcons and we've kind of moved away from those positions, but we kind of became lefcoms in response to like our own personal experiences with sex and stuff.
Yeah.
Like what drove me to become an ultra left was having a deal with the Farizzo Fight Back people when I was a student in Tampa. And that kind of drove me to just, you know, take on this really ultra left attitude towards everything.
Why do both hard and soft Maoists tend to drive people to that? Like, what do you think that is? And as a second question, the reverse also happens, which is fascinating.
I noticed that there is kind of a ultra to Maoist pipe or anarchist to Maoist pipeline. And I think Frizzo to me aren't even Maoist. They use Mao's. I'm talking about Frizzo Fight Back, the more hardline Frizzos, the one they split with another group that still calls themselves Frizzo over Tiananmen Square, with like Frizzo still, the Frizzo I know of and talking about still upholding, you know, the modern Chinese state and the repression of Tiananmen. And the other Frizzo is a more soft Maoist group.
Yeah, they're not really. They're popular frontists now, pretty much, right?
Like, well, so is one of the things that kind of drove me to ultra-leftism was the other Frizzo. They kind of also were popular frontists. They just were very sneaky about it. Like, I realized that all the activism they did was just forming front groups and then tailing whatever the latest liberal cause was, and then using that to recruit activists, then sending these activists into industry. And so I saw that it was almost like a multi, you know, it was MLM, multi-level marketing scheme, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was so, talking about the sectarian MLM the other day, maybe on your wall, where I said, you know, a lot of this is multi-level marketing Marxism.
Yeah, it's too similar, but it's, and so that whole experience with Frizzo kind of drove me into ultra-leftism. And so I think we kind of were, you know, we met each other because we were at that point in our politics.
Yeah, similar with me when I'm dealing with, actually mine was interesting because it came from the other direction. It was dealing with a mixture of soft Maoist and social Democrats in the SPUSA, which I was really trying hard to join. And they just kept on turning me off. Like, I'm just like, Jesus, like, what's wrong with you today? And when I got out of that, I kind of moved to the Platypus Affiliated Society, which is a little bit ironic because a lot of them are in the SPUSA now. I guess that's kind of openly known.
Oh yeah, Platypus is all over SPUSA.
Right.
It's not what I did not expect that term either.
No, I was like, what? When I first heard that. And I kind of got burnt with that, and then I think by the time I came to you, like, I was still working for the North Star, but the North Star was really falling apart, like, already. And one of its, I mean, like, how many editorial boards has it had? I mean, one of the funny things is one of our mutual acquaintances in the Marxist Center, Sophia Burns, was also an editor of the North Star, but of a completely different time period, and I didn't even know who they were until that point. Like, it was, so these kind of publications and groups kind of bubble up and fall apart. And we have mutual connections through when I was in the Red Party, which was adjacent to some stuff you did. So that's our history. But I'm not as interested in that as interested in the is in your academic research and how that kind of led you out of LeftCom, like the hard LeftComism.
I think what kind of led me out of left communism was just trying to actually organize in the real world according to left communist ideas and realizing that if you're completely anti-union, if you're completely anti-voting, if you actually want to try to build like cadre and try to organize and get involved in stuff, it's just, it doesn't work very well with the left com ideology where everything within capitalism except for spontaneous revolts is bad, and so all you can really do is kind of shout slogans and propaganda at people.
So you either become an internet activist or you try to organize a riot.
Like, yeah, exactly. It's just doesn't work in practice. You have to make some concessions with reality if you want to do politics. That's just, Marx realizes this, Lenin realizes this, and really
even Bordiga realized this, let's be honest.
Yeah, even Bordiga did, even though he didn't, you know, I think learning a bit more about the history also of the Comintern and kind of what the actual positions of the left communists had and seeing that they were actually wrong, that kind of was a factor as well. But also when you just study history, you realize that things are just a lot more complex than this, you know, class against class narrative. And most class struggle doesn't really fit into these kind of purist narratives that left comms try to project onto everything. That's one thing that I would say was related to my academic studies, at least, because I studied U.S. labor history, history of U.S. communism, and a history of communism in relation to civil rights, actually. And that was a lot of what I studied when I was in grad school.
So you're one of those people like me who knows all about the Stalinists in the 20s being actually like doing God's work in this weird way.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It's actually very inspiring to read about because... I mean, that actually
ruined it all.
Well, yeah, the Popular Front really screwed things up, but also a factor, I guess, reading about that history made me realize that like the left-com narrative of history is that like, oh, everyone who didn't, you know, split from the Comintern over the right thing was just like this traitor, and they were bourgeois, and they were fighting for capitalism, really. And so, but then you read about these Stalinists in the South in the late 20s and early 30s, like doing God's work, as you said, and it's like, wait a second, maybe this super reductive narrative of history where everything touched by Stalinism is evil, and Trotskyism is just another faction of capitalism, it's just not, it just doesn't hold up.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about that is I realized that professed ideology of leadership doesn't really always, like, rack it down. You know what I mean?
Oh, like, yeah, definitely. Especially concerning the work of the U.S., the CPUSA in the South, which is interesting because a lot of people talk about the Black Belt Theory and how it was, you know, this super important idea for the CPUSA. But if you actually read the scholarship, the actual on-the-ground organizers rarely ever agitated, like, for a black belt. They usually did the kind of work that civil rights activists would later do, rather than kind of, you know, agitate for a black nation in the South and stuff. So there is this kind of narrative that the CPUSA was, you know, the black belt was kind of their key to being able to organize blacks, but it really wasn't actually. And under on the ground activity, that whole Stalinist kind of nationalist ideology really didn't actually factor into their organizing.
No, to me, when I read that, they mostly seem like the most radical wing of the NAACP, to be frank, but
yeah,
with a labor component, like, and they seem somewhat similar to the who. I'm going to be specific on factions because people like to talk about the Black Panthers as if they were unified, which is nuts.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
But the Huey Newton, Fred Hampton faction of the Black Panthers, as opposed to like the Cleaver and probably they were less radical than that. But I mean, like, they were doing really good work and really important work. And it has been documented now. I mean, so at least there's that. I mean,
I was going to say is that it's been kind of historically accepted, even amongst bourgeois scholars, that a lot of the work the communists did in the South laid the groundwork for the civil rights movement.
Yeah, it's just funny because when they tried to bring it back in the 60s, it didn't work. Like, Ignatieff, yeah, who's one of, like, I remember all those people who tried to do that in the CPUSA in the 60s, with you know, the people came up with black skin privilege theory and all that. I mean, white skin privilege theory. Let me be very specific. That's a pretty big fuck up. But
no, I know exactly. You're talking about the
yeah,
the Sojourner Truth people, the Sojourner Truth organization. Yeah,
but they didn't get anywhere within the CPUSA with that, and ended up having to split from it. So that's interesting to me. But anyway, to bring it back to what got you out of this, basically, you and I both studied. You studied American labor history. I studied the Soviet Union, and came away thinking that, like, the first thing for me was state capitalist theory. And
yes, yeah,
and
yeah.
I kept on thinking, like, look, there's four components of capital. Like, there's four vectors of capitalism. State capitalism says that the Soviet Union was capitalist because of one.
Exactly, and it's always exaggerated to the one they pick. You ever see existence of the formal wage relation, or it's the existence of trading on the world market?
I mean, a lot of people will say it's the existence of the value form, period. And I was like, okay, I mean, I see your point, but if you take that stance, then, like, pretty much all of history becomes capitalist.
That's one thing that, yeah, state capitalism was one of the first leftcon dogmas I really just, yeah, kind of threw away, because I did a bunch of studying on my own time on the Soviet Union. I really wanted to get to the bottom of it. And I basically came to the conclusion that if you are using Marxist capital as a kind of guiding post for what capitalism is, and you look at capitalism in historical perspective, and you actually look at what the Soviet Union empirically was historically, you just cannot uphold state capitalist theory, in my opinion. There's so many logical holes in it that you can just, it's like Swiss cheese. You can just poke holes in it all day long.
I think you and I are both deformed worker statist. Not even that. I'm actually a bureaucratic collectivist, but deformed worker statist is close to my position. It just presupposes some things that I don't think you can presuppose.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know if I could explain my position if just like a phrase. Like, the generated worker state, the foreign worker state has elements of truth. Bureaucratic collectivism has elements of truth. But really, the guy to look at is Tikhon, if you really want to start looking at these issues seriously, in my opinion. Because he calls it a non-mode of production, which is kind of like, non-mode of production, that's fucking dumb. But really, it's he has a very sophisticated argument, and once you lay it out, it makes a lot of sense. The Soviet Union did not have definable, laws of motion and rules of reproduction that you can use to identify a coherent mode of production.
No,
like with capitalism. So with capitalism, we have the law of value that we can see. And we can see how much the law of value dominates a society.
Well, the funny thing about, I was talking to someone about this morning, like if you look at Gosplan uses, at first it uses labor charts that you pull straight from Capital Volume 1 and 2, and then it kind of gets off on some different things later. But like, none of it worked. But the reason why it didn't work wasn't their calculations. It was the fact that they weren't getting honest inputs into anything.
Yeah, exactly. The inputs and outputs were just not, they were so at variance that you could hardly call it planning.
Right. I mean, it's just like when everyone's afraid of being shot and they lie all the time, like good inputs. And what's funny about that, I mean, I know you're a Soviet, you and I are slightly different. You're a little bit more Soviet defensive than I am. That's a weird adjective, but you kind of take a line similar to maybe the dreaded Sparts.
Well, I'd say that like overall until the end, I'd say the Soviet Union should at least be defended militarily against U.S. imperialism.
Well, yeah. I mean, to me, that's
like, that would be. I would just say, like, by defensist, like, if I say, I am kind of a Soviet defensist, I don't mean to say that I uphold it as, like, a form of socialism to copy, or that it was, like, a superior form of non-class society, per se, but that just, it was a progressive force in history, basically.
Yeah.
And,
my stance is the fall of the Soviet Union is a world historic tragedy.
Yeah, and that's really what made me kind of a defensist, basically, was seeing the utter, what actually happened when U.S. imperialism was able to break down the Soviet Union. So I guess, yeah, you could say my position is kind of close to, like, orthodox Trotz, criticize the Stalinist bureaucracy, but still defend deformed worker state, whatever you want to call it, from capitalist restoration and whatever you want to call it.
I'm somewhere between the Orthodox Trotskyist stance and like some kind of left com. Like I'm the center between there. But you are currently working on this project called Cosmonaut, which is rethinking and kind of proposing communist strategy in a, I'm going to say it, you don't say it this way, but I'm just going to be frank, in a post-DSA world. I don't think that was what you were initially thinking about, but that's the milieu we're all in. Like, everybody's liquidated into the DSA, and it hasn't actually changed things that much.
Yeah, I would say at this point, the DSA is basically the movement as it exists, and that's a problem, and it's also, it changes the landscape, but it's still, you know, it's a problem as well.
So one of the things I've noticed is I'm wondering how long that's going to last given the last election cycle, because the DSA did what a lot of the trots, you know, a lot of the most, I wouldn't say conservative trots, but the most orthodox trots would say, is they may have accidentally revitalized the Democratic center, not the Democratic left.
Yeah, I think it's, if you actually look at the total amount of wins that the DSA had, the last election was not a victory for progressive Democrats. Yeah, it was not a victory for the DSA.
And if you weren't in New, if you weren't in New York State, basically, you didn't, and you were a DSA aligned, you didn't really do that well.
Yeah, exactly. And there's all kinds of idiocy going around the DSA right now about why. For example, someone named Abu El Said ran in Michigan. And, you know, he was endorsed by Bernie Sanders. He worked with Bernie Sanders, I guess. And the DSA, this guy, Benjamin Studebaker, he says that the real reason he didn't win was because we're already trying to persuade people this kind of politics can win elections. It's a lot easier to do when the candidate is named Bernie rather than Abdul. And he ends it with saying, next time we go for a governorship in a red state, let's try a white guy with a name like Bob. So it's like they kind of learned the opposite lessons of what to actually do, in my opinion, which is they move more and more towards centrist Democrats instead of getting more left-wing when they lose.
Yeah, well, my friend in the New Orleans DSA said something interesting to me once. He said that, yes, the DSA should have left the Socialist International, but that since they didn't propose an alternative Social Democratic International more true to their values, they had effectively given up internationalism by doing that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And I actually kind of thought about that, and I thought, yeah, that is a good point, and that's kind of worrying, because...
Well, I would take it a step further and say that Harrington himself was an anti-internationalist who supported the labor bureaucracy's nationalist tendencies and was anti-Soviet, you know, in a way that makes me want to be Soviet defensive, because total scab in the Cold War.
I mean, to be when Max Shackman is to the left of you, I mean, I know
exactly.
I know what I'm talking about, but when Max Shackman is to the left of you, you have an issue.
Well, yeah, and yeah, exactly. Like the whole thing about Harrington and Shackman is these were socialists who were ex-Trotskyist who had decided to basically side with the United States against the Soviet Union because they thought that the Soviet Union posed a greater threat to world democratic liberty or whatever.
Yeah, but to be fair to Shackman, that's already kind of in Tony Cliff. Like, oh, I'm going to upset some people with saying that, but it is. Like,
yeah,
when
yeah.
he miraculously discovered, you know, Marxist humanist / leftcom a state capitalist theory out of nowhere that seemed to be oddly, you know, suspiciously timed with the Vietnam War. It was something else.
If you think about it, like if you were alive during back then, would you not be supporting the victory of the Vietnamese? Not just the defeat of the U.S., but we want the Vietnamese to win. Like, I just think that, and I think a lot of the kind of capitalist theorists, like they kind of, yeah, they made that up so they didn't have to take the hard side and actually defend the North Vietnamese and just say a pox on both houses.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing to me about that, I really thought a lot, because my natural state is a pox on both houses on a lot of the time, I'm not going to lie, but when I really studied the Vietnamese in particular, there was a chance where they would not have gone Stalinist. Like,
yeah.
There really was actually similar to Cuba in this regard. And the response to the U.S. is what pushed them that way. I mean, like, Ho Chi Minh in particular is really fascinating, and the fact that he was always kind of communist-y, but at one point he was much more open to the United States than at later points. I mean, like, it was when we openly supported a reactionary quasi-colonialist power.
Yeah, he was exactly.
Like, fuck you guys.
Yeah, I think, like, when I was more ultra-left, my natural reaction to Vietnam was just, oh, you know, state capitalist Stalinist versus U.S. imperialist, but obviously it's horrible what we're doing. Or what we did, but when I study Vietnam more closely, I really do find the Vietnamese Stalinists, at least, you know, it's hard to say that they're not at least the better side, at least, you know, at least right. We want, you know, it just seems that they obviously are fighting for a just cause.
The other thing is about the Vietnamese Stalinist is, I don't want to romanticize Vietnam, even now, but like, they're pretty rational actors. Like, they're not
exactly
a ideological state. Like,
it's like, not like, like, they're not like Pol Pot, for example.
Right. When confronted with the Khmer Rouge, they were like, this is bad.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The U.S. made them look like rational actors.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you study them. So I guess the moral of the story is shit's complicated. And maybe that's the moral of Cosmonaut 2, to make a pivot to your...
Okay, yeah, so let's go back to Cosmonaut, because, yeah, our idea generally is to kind of fill in a gap of something that's kind of, I guess... Well, you have Jacobin, which is kind of like a, you know, a left social democratic magazine, and so I guess the idea of Cosmonaut would be kind of for people who want something a little bit more radical and actually communist.
Mm-hmm.
Is kind of what we're trying to do, but not ultra left per se, like Commune magazine.
Yeah, but not Commune, not in what is the other one? Intransigence, or even maybe Viewpoints. Like you're more.
Yeah, we're more solid orthodox Marxist, you know, pro Bolshevik for the most part. Just general, well, I guess, you know, people
I
very inspired by. Yeah, generally inspired by Weekly Workers' general line, I'd say.
Yeah. And so you guys tend
but
to
not
like,
identical.
No, I that's definitely the case. And also interestingly, like you guys tend to side with Trotz a lot of the time, but if I asked you if you supported, for example, the transitional program, you would kind of be like, no.
Oh, I mean, lately I've been getting more and more infuriated with Trotsky because I've been reading more about him and the debates with Bukharin and just how Trotsky kind of comes off as a sectarian little prick in a lot of cases. Like, I really think that it was Bukharin rather than Trotsky that probably should have been in charge, and then as opposed to Stalin, because I think Trotsky really didn't actually have as well thought out of a plan as Bukharin did.
Well, what is it the left comp say that I think is true, that Trotsky's agricultural policy was actually the worst shit that Stalin did? Like,
yeah, that's my point, is that, you know, Stalin really, a lot of Trotsky's followers in the left opposition ended up jumping into Stalin's camp when he started the collectivization, which was an absolute disaster. It was really Bukharin who was against that and stood against that.
The scholar James Hartfield from the UK does critique Bukharin and blames the Ukrainian famine on the Stalinization of Bukharin's NEP, but I be honest with you, that interpretation's beyond me, but that's the only interpretation that I've ever seen that tries to make Bukharin kind of look like the bad guy.
Yeah, I think that's an absolute nonsense. Like, the NEP was destroyed by collectivization, not the other. It was not a continuation of the NEP. It was a complete destruction of the state that was built as an alliance between the workers and the peasants under the NEP. But yeah, this is kind of getting in the historical minutia.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah. But so to bring it all back to Cosmonaut, there was this idea that came from two separate places, and this is kind of interesting to think about, called the Marxist Center. And I say it came from two separate places because it came partly from Hal Draper and the post ISO like Monthly Review Marxist Center. And then partly from Mike Metnair's book, Revolutionary Strategy. And Cosmonaut seems to not have stayed in that Marxist center realm entirely. but it kind of was inspired by that, particularly for those of us who kind of came out of the left milieu where we're like, okay, well, we realize this is not like historically nuanced enough. So what else do we have?
And I guess kind of the point of Cosmonaut, you said, is kind of say, all right, listen, there are things that we don't understand and there's questions that still have to be answered. And to figure out the answer to these questions, we're going to have to debate things out. And we need we need to do this intellectually and intelligently. And so I guess I kind of see Cosmonaut as just kind of part of that process of us trying to debate these questions of Marxism that are relevant to modern day strategy, relevant to, you know, our historical understanding, our understanding of Marxism, and basically create a space where we can, you know, as Platypus says, host the conversation, but still kind of have a general political line of being pro-revolutionary Marxism.
So this has been tried many times before. That's not a critique. That's just sort of a statement of fact. Like,
I would say we're just one of many different, you know, like journals.
Monthly Review, for example, started that way. I mean, when I think about Monthly Review in the 70s and 80s.
Well, that's actually funny because someone compared us to Monthly Review.
Well, I mean, the funny thing about Monthly Review is everyone's like, oh my God, there's, you like Maoist
advocates. Oh, that's an honor to be compared to Monthly Review.
And they kind of are now sometimes. Maoist, I mean, like, I don't love Sweezy, for example, but they also, you know, Draper and the political Marxist, you know, Merkin Wood and Brenner and all those guys and other peeps were writing for Monthly Review, particularly in the 70s and 80s. And I do think, like, and honestly, even to this day, their publication imprint keeps some good stuff that would have been forgotten about entirely.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Like Chris Caldwell. Like, no, like if it wasn't for Monthly Review, I know Verso's published one thing by then, but if it wasn't for Monthly Review keeping him on the catalog, it would have probably been forgotten about. Like, so they're interesting, but I don't know that they serve the same function that they originally did. So I guess the question is, this magazine exists in a spectrum to be sort of like more radical than the Social Democrats, not left communist, and also not particularly sectarian. Like that's the, like, because you could say, oh, there's all these Trotskyist mags and imprints and stuff that serve similar functions, but they're all explicitly Trotskyist.
Yeah, exactly. Like we would publish something by a Trotskyist and then something by an ML, then something by a left com, no problem.
Yeah, you have published a couple like Trotskyist and anti-Trotskyist already. Like, I mean, I could tell you that from the list of authors you have right now.
Yeah, exactly.
So the article I read by you, which is your own inaugural article from in the journal, and I know like Cosmonaut kind of wants to develop a line where the editors are not constantly the people writing for it, but you did write an article called From a Workers' Party to a Workers' Republic. And to me, it was interesting because it is a break from some of your prior work, but it's consistent with some themes for some things you wrote for the Communist League of Tampa and for LibCom about 2 or 3 years ago. So for example, when you talk about the Workers' Party needing to exist, you make sure that that people understand that you're talking about a communist workers' party and not just a generic labor party, because while the generic labor party may or may not be nationalist, the tendency for it to become nationalist for structural reasons is kind of always there, where a communist party would have a platform prohibition for going in that direction.
Yeah, exactly. I think the difference between a plain labor party and a communist party is that a labor party is designed to, it's supposed to represent the interests of the working class within capitalism and basically win the working class the best possible deal within capitalism. Mm-hmm. Whereas the aim of a communist party is to organize the proletariat around the program to overthrow a capitalist state and overcome capitalism. Not just program, but it has a general political end that it's aiming for. Yeah. It's not simply just looking to defend the interests of the working class. Oh, it does do that. It does fight for reforms. It still is aiming for something more than that.
It has to use Aristotelian terms, it has a larger teleology, but yeah.
So, yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
So one of the things that you point out is that a bourgeois labor party is also going to have a tendency to be a nationalistic labor party because bourgeois organization is still exist. Even though the capitalist totality is not on the level of a nation state, its organizational forms tend to be on the level of a nation state. And so if you're a bourgeois labor party, will kind of have a tendency to become nationalist regardless.
I think that that follows. It's a general tendency that's created from reformism as a strategy pursued by a labor party, because you're trying to get the best deal within capitalism, which means that eventually at some point it's going to become a class compromise, like some kind of corporatist arrangement. And that means you're going to want your economy, your national economy, to be as competitive as possible and on the international level, which is going to mean supporting nationalistic policies to improve the general national economy. And so it leads to a dilution of class politics through nationalism. And so I guess a common thread throughout my work, I guess, would be that we need to constantly fight against the influence of nationalism in the labor movement.
Yeah, so, and let's be frank. Do you and I both see a resurgence in nationalism in the labor movement?
I don't know about the labor movement so much as just like the intellectual left,
there's also another Frank. It's not that the labor movement's dead. I think that's an overstatement, but it's pretty dormant.
I actually think that it's on a comeback. I think it's been relatively so. There has been a lot more strikes lately than I think that there is a kind of a labor movement in formation right now. I don't think it's too much in its infancy to say the labor movement has an ideology. And I think what we do have is a left, and there is ideological divisions in the left, and a response to Trumpism and Bannonism, or whatever you want to call it, this kind of anti-globalist right-wing critique of capitalism, has often led to the left turning more towards the right in a lot of its political positions.
Yeah. I like to call it post-neoliberal Alex Jones thought, but I mean, it's funny. I say that actually kind of as a joke, but kind of seriously, because the vocabulary of even the mainstream right is identical to shit that I heard Alex Jones say in the 90s.
Oh, yeah, totally. Like, Alex Jones has become a serious right-wing thinker in a weird way.
And also in a weird way, it's kind of destroyed him. But
what's funny about Alex Jones just is that, like, all of his stuff is about God. Like, if you listen to him and listen to his whole, like, mythology, it all goes back to God and Satan. Like, the globalists are Satan, and the info warriors against the globalists are, you know, the forces of Christ. And so it makes sense that he's so popular, because people in America are so religious, so they can believe this shit because they say that it's about Jesus, you know? So
the other interesting thing about Alex Jones, and this is little known even by people who are leftists who are always calling him a fascist, he cribbed a lot of language in the 90s from the militia movement explicitly.
Oh, I totally believe that. I mean,
quasi-deracialized it. And I'm going to interview a guy in a couple of weeks, just a normal liberal guy, but who actually documented all the essays that had the vocabulary that he started using in the mid-90s, and he still uses.
Yeah, the whole New World Order sounds like Zionist occupied government. Illuminati is, you know, the Jews.
But even stuff like leaderless resistance, which has a kind of innocuous, like, 60s...
white nationalist ideal.
Going back to 1992, like in 1992, there's the Grand Dragon of the Klan picked up the leaderless resistance, actually weirdly from the New Left, and used it as a model. And it kind of had this idea of like quasi-terrorists. I mean, kind of similar to ISIS, actually. Quasi-terrorist cells maintaining, you know.
Yeah.
And the structure of it was actually tactical, because nobody could betray anyone else. If you caught someone, then they wouldn't be able to squeal.
Yeah, James Mason's siege is like the Bible of that whole thing.
Yep.
And that's the whole Adam Waffen Division group.
Yeah, but, and that goes back to the grant. It was on a bulletin board, and that essay is quoted in right wing circles all the time. Alex Jones was using that language as early as 1998. I mean, this is not like, oh, this is all a fascist conspiracy. I don't think Alex Jones is that coherent.
Yeah, he's not.
My point in this is I've also seen that kind of stuff resurge. I've seen it on the left a couple times. Like, look, I got taken in by it in the early aughts. in the first left to right movement. It was for different reasons.
Oh, but yeah, I you see, I mean, it's in all kinds of different sections of the left, because you have the kind of the PSL, WWP people kind of use Duganist language when they talk about geopolitics. I think talk about how we need to defeat unipolarity with multipolarity, and it's like, you realize that's like Dugan's like geopolitics.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, they got one of their dudes got infiltrated. I mean, not to defend the PSL, but are the WWP. Actually, more the WP. They did kick this guy out. But there was, you know, a major figure that I won't name in the WWP who got infiltrated by Duganist.
Oh, I know who you're talking about.
It took them forever to realize it. Like, it took them like 2-3 years. And I also remember back in the 2012-2013, even a lot of like people who are not that sketchy were picking up on RT's / anti-NATO propaganda that was explicitly pro-Russia. And look, like, as a side note, there is actually some logic to some of the shit Russia does. They're not irrational actors. But, like, I don't buy the Russia conspiracy either.
Yeah, exactly. There is a knee-jerk anti-imperialism that gets on my nerves. But yeah, there's also this kind of weird, like, red-brown anti-imperialist tendency.
Well, the counterpunch was this for a long time, like brown-red alliance thought.
Yeah. Well, before it was kind of like Ron Paul unite with the left, but now it's like, you know, now the Ron Paulers are all alt-right, it's kind of entering a darker territory.
Right. Well, like, nationalists and communists are the only people who can defeat liberalism. Right.
Yeah, like, I mean, look at Nova Russia or you know, Donbass. Like, that's literally an on the ground red brown alliance between communists and nationalists against you know, the Ukrainian neoliberal fascist. It's pretty insane.
Yeah, that really is a pox on both your houses scenario.
Yeah, that's an example of a dog I have no fight in. Like, I'm not going to cheer for either side now.
Yeah,
I cheer for the Viet Cong, but not the Donbass rebels or the Ukrainian liberal.
They also feel that way about Syria. But
same about Syria. I think actually that's an article I want to write about for Cosmonaut. Is just kind of how much insanity on both sides that Syria has caused in the left.
Oh yeah, like, no, it's
just
nuts.
Utter insanity from people who are otherwise rational thinkers, I think.
And it's been going on for 5 years. When I took over North Star, that was the first major debates we had, was a person who was literally, another person I'm not going to out, but when we got to the North Star Twitter, our person was pro the Free Syrian Army.
Yeah,
He was actually following, our Twitter was actually following jihadists.
Oh my god.
Like on Twitter and and like not ISIS, but like Al Qaeda adjacent affiliates.
Yeah, like Al Nusra Front and stuff like that.
Yeah. And then the other side of that debate were like people who wrote under pen names like Red Demestre.
Yeah. I see what you mean. I see it's insane. Because the really hardcore pro-Assad left, like, definitely, you know, the alt-right is really pro-Assad. Like, it just seems like when you're the only tanky out there really standing against liberalism, that your only allies are these insane third positionists.
Right. Juste defenders were like that too for the longest time, even before the Marcyite parties, like the PSL and the WWP started defending Juste hardcore. The only people defending them would be Maoist Rebel Radio. And then if you actually looked at the Juse Society, most of them were like right nationalist, third positionist Duganists. In fact, Vice did a real good expose of them in like 2013.
Yeah, I remember reading that. That was an eye-opener. But the problem is that these people do damage to the left by helping liberals basically, you know, feel their idea that, oh, we have to fight extremism, the left and the fascist are...
I mean, because it makes horseshoe theory look correct, and because in a certain way, I'm not defending horseshoe theory in ideological terms, but if you look at the subjects that the left and the alt-rightists attract, there is actually an overlap right now. And that's not good. I mean, this is why I think the labor movement resurgence is sort of a necessary evil, because otherwise, or evil, and that's not evil, but like,
it's necessary.
It's necessary because, I mean, even if you have to deal with some reformist crap, that's the evil part of it.
Yeah.
Because without it, you just kind of have deracinated students to pick up from. Mm-hmm. Like that's the only subject you have.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And it's just, that's a whole other topic, but so, yeah, and it becomes like this kind of SJW versus alt-right culture war, and some people just go insane over it and just end up falling into the right because they end up going more and more towards the right. And I guess that's kind of one thing I've wanted to do with Cosmod, is kind of actually provide a real rational alternative to the alt-right that actually deals with issues in a materialist sense and not just, you know, in a kind of a empty leftist moralizing sense, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense to me. I mean, so I'm going to tell you the story of my two proteges at North Star. I haven't talked about this a lot, but I won't mention their names out of respect, but you can probably look it up. One of them now hangs up with Milo Yiannopoulos. And the other of them started a leftcom journal, but is now like an ultra dingist.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, you know who I'm talking about on both sides. One of those people is famous, or quasi-famous, yeah. Like for a leftist famous. They've done interviews on Tucker Carlson and on Riley and stuff. And the
That's scary, because I mean, North Star at one point did kind of seem like it could be like this kind of pan-leftist journal for debate between people in the movement and people who aren't academics but kind of independent researchers, which is kind of what Cosmonaut's trying to do, is they're trying to build something outside academia that's getting voices from movements and outside these institutions
and who's also not a party affiliate. Yeah, North Star tried that. I mean, and that's why I think what you're doing is really important, but also like I fear for you.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think it comes down to having a solid group of writers who are just committed and have a clear vision. I think that's one of the things you need.
And you need people who aren't good. I mean, what happened to us, to give you a little bit of back politics before those people, because those people didn't go crazy first. If I went through the North Star editors and my chosen successors and stuff, I could tell you a lot of horror stories about them. But what broke them for the most part was the aftermath of the Mark Fisher affair, and people cut in different directions.
So, yeah, I can. So the Mark Fisher affair was the whole like Vampire Castle article on.
Mm-hmm. And like we have Malice on our we have Malice on our editorial board. I had some former SALT people on the editorial board. I mean, people don't realize that like when I was the editor, we literally went out of our way to get multiple tendencies represented in the editorialship. And we had gotten along even with the Syria crap, even with debates about anarchist, you know, with left comms, with, you know, me publishing Malice one day and Bordigas the next, you know. But the Mark Fisher thing got so nasty, particularly with our UK writers, that people didn't feel like they could be neutral anymore, that they could maintain an objective position. And I left. Like, it, not because of the ideological fallout, actually, although that was part of it. The biggest reason I left was trying to manage the herd of cats became too much of my life to do. Like, it just, I couldn't maintain a job and do it.
Yeah, so it just sounds like basically everyone, it's just, I don't even think that article has flaws, but it's just not. It's not like Nagel's article for yeah, it's just saying that there's toxic behavior in the left. Like, that's not really that controversial.
Well, it's funny because nobody sees it as controversial now. Even people who denounced it have said, oh, it's actually better than...
Yeah.
The point is, in some ways, though, to pivot back to what we want to talk about, if we'd have studied communist history, some of this wouldn't have been surprising to us.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah,
this has happened 100,000 times before. So I found your article very interesting because one thing that you seem to be calling for, and I haven't seen called for a lot, is a communist republic, not just the workers' democracy talk. And the other thing that you did is you went through the transitions from the Communist League to the First Comintern, and really the Second International and the Third. So do you want to go into why that's important?
Yeah, I'll start on the whole kind of question of what I call communist republicanism. And I think this is an important part of Marxism that a lot of people miss out on, is that the aim of Marxism is to abolish all exploitation and oppression. It's not merely just simply to put the means of production in the hands of the working class and have a transfer of private property. Our aim is to essentially transcend the entire basis of society that creates oppressive and exploitative relations. And I think that republicanism and the ideals of republicanism were a really important thing for Marx and are extremely impactful on Marx. And I think that with the Soviet experiment and with kind of the rise of Marxism, Leninism, these kind of democratic republican aspects of Marxist thoughts have kind of been shut down and forgotten about and kind of dismissed as bourgeois. But it's really important to understand that the common values and ideas that Marx and his colleagues like spoke in was basically radical republicanism combined with utopian socialism, combined with the social science, basically. And so I think because we aim to not just abolish exploitation but also abolish oppression, we have to look at political power relations and how we can construct a society where people aren't dominated by political power relations. And this is something that Mike McNair goes into that has really inspired me. And so my argument is essentially that a worker state has to be based on principles of democratic republicanism, because it has to be based on a true community of labor actively, collectively making decisions for the interests of all in an accountable way. And you have to find mechanism and structures of doing this.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's episode. Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives are produced for Zero Books by the team of C. Derek Varn, J.G. Michael, Amog Sahu, and Toby Kamir, our ever-faithful producer and editor. Please keep following us on the Inside Zero Books Patreon account for additional episodes. Have a good day.